Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passaran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by content creator and influencer Tom Tanaki. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Young influencer Tom Tanaki. Young up-and-coming influencer. Big on TikTok. Has one of those little mics. Those little microphones. This has been going for 10 years now. This isn't even a young influencer thing. It's just like anyone below 40 years of age just has those little puff things, a little wattle puff, but black, and they hold that rather than having a microphone. I think it gives like a rough-hewn appeal to them or something.
Yeah, and it's working for you. People are thinking he's a man of the people.
Yeah, man of the people, like to get out there and irritate people in person and get good content out of it. That's my jam. I've got a Drew Pavlou-esque sort of thing. That's me. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to speak to the left's Drew Pavlou. Tom, I wanted to talk to you about the March for Australia, which you covered in a recent video on YouTube.com. Could you tell us what has become of the Patriots?
Yeah, I've done three videos on the March for Australia and covering their three rounds of rallies that they got to experience. And you can track a pretty significant tone with this from my first to the second and third, really. They share something in common. It was only the first. You had to give it to them on the first rally because it was an intimidating moment to be there staring those rallies down in their thousands. They got, on my estimate was that they got between 80 and 100,000 out, something of that order anyway. The exact numbers fail me now, but they were a big deal for an AI-generated video with almost immediate Nazi support, lending to the idea that it might have been Nazi back, that it got viral appeal and then was just taken over for organizational purposes by a ragtag assembly of patriot and nationalist types. The level of success that they had was incredible and daunting. We thought, okay, we're watching our latest reclaim moment, and who knows what kind of movement this will lead to, particularly given the way that the NSN showed up and dominated the rallies and really made themselves an organised show of violent force, the likes of which I had never seen. The far left, far right scene across Australia before. That was a daunting moment. So when I say tonal shift, for the second and third, they just lost all their numbers. And they lost, I calculated it for the second video, they lost about 85% of their numbers for it. But my assumption would be that when they went on to do their third rally, that they would get some of them back. Because, of course, for many patriots, nationalists and organised and disorganised racists, the 26th of January is the National Day for Racism, isn't it? And an excellent day, one would think, to start arranging for white supremacists and white nationalists and such to all get together and get out to actively politicise the day, not simply as a day for half-heartedly bashing migrants and Indigenous people and all those sorts of causes, but to actually get people under the banner of stopping all mass immigration and kicking everyone out and white supremacy and Australia for the white man and that sort of thing. And it would be an excellent day for that. And I wasn't too stunned given the performance of the second rally, but I was somewhat surprised to see that the third rally had absolutely no bump in attendance from the second whatsoever. You have the best day in the year with all of Australia's mainstream and even like political constructs doing their best to hand it to you, to make it the National Day of Racism. You really have it handed to you on a platter. It's Christmas for racists. Theirs for the taking. And they had the best construct going in years. They had the best outfit, I suppose you'd say, the best setup going to help explode the 26th of January 2026 as an explicitly organised white supremacist, white isolationist political cause on that day. And they couldn't do it. So I spent my third video talking about why. Oh, it was mine to sit there and theorise as to why that was. And so that was my interest for the third March for Australia video. Why did they manage to get it so wrong? How did they have this big opportunity in their hands, given how successful the first rallies were, and only two events later, how are they suddenly getting it so wrong? And so that's why my third video is called March for Australia 3, A Poisoned Well, because I was trying to think about what set them back from the outset. And I basically set upon tonal issues in the rally. They weren't sure whether they wanted to be a celebration of Australia, which is really where a lot of its nationalist power comes from, that they get to defend themselves against accusations of racism on the 26th of January by saying, oh, we just love our bloody country. And then after a month of doing a lot of quite nationalist and discriminatory things, they then get to say, no, this is just a day for celebration and just loving your country, mate. So they couldn't decide whether they wanted to be that or whether they actually just wanted to get together and do what a lot of white nationalist activists stuck together does, which is whinging or taking a melting pot of different causes and gripes together. And I thought there was those tonal issues. And I also had issues with the organisers. I identified issues with the essential lack of capacity among the organisers and lack of riz. There was something wrong with these people. I just don't think a lot of them were up to it. There's oddballs among their management, some really funny odd people, and some people who I just think they got. I talked at the start about ways in which some people just found themselves harnessing the power of these viral videos and using it because they just wanted something to do. And they found themselves in a position of suddenly having something very important to do. And they pointed themselves as organisers and then they got to speak at the rallies and all that kind of thing. But to my mind, that doesn't mean that you're an effective nationalist organiser. You've got to have a bit of riz for that. In my experience, people like their nationalist organised racist leaders to have a bit of oomph, and I didn't identify that in some of these people. I just think they were happy to be there, but didn't really have the charm to get it happening. You know what I mean? They want their little Hitlers. They want their people who are good at speeches, have a bit of oomph, have a bit of leadership riz, and I don't think that existed among this lot.
Tom, would you say that they were Icarus mogged by hubris maxing?
Yeah, I would. Actually, you took the right words right out of my mouth there, Cam. Yeah, that's right. Icarus wing-maxed until he was sun-mogged.
Tom, along with many thousands that mobilised on those occasions, I guess you could say that the August event came to be better known as the site of an alleged assault, and then in Perth or other parts of the country in January, a man was alleged to have thrown an IED into the crowd and he's being prosecuted for that offence. So I guess I'm wondering, in addition to the kind of organisational disarray or half-hearted or whatever flaws there were in the organisation of those events, they did attract, as you say, a whole range of different people, some of whom chose to express their antagonism to Indigenous people in a very worrying fashion. What do you see as being, like, beneath the kinds of these spectacles, how do you see the ideology manifesting, or what are the ideological currents that you detect in this movement that might be cause for greater concern?
Yeah, it's an interesting – thank you for pointing that out. And it's what makes it a bit fraught talking about – it's fraught for me to sit here and say, smirk about the lack of rally attendance on this day for these events when really – one of the most remarkable things about it was not that it was, we had a very near miss of a great expression of violence against Indigenous people and the leftists of all stripes who stand alongside them at the Invasion Day rallies. And we almost saw that in Perth. And then we had someone else not long after, of course, didn't we, arrested for more planned attacks, I think also over in Perth. Correct me if I'm wrong there. There's been a lot of arrests of people, thankfully, who were in the planning stages for acts of great violence against the left in Australia. And but for those near misses, for example, but for the apparent fluke failed detonation of alleged bomb in Perth on the 26th, we would have seen violence the likes of which, single expressions of mass violence the likes of which we're not used to seeing in the modern political context in Australia. In fact, you leave it to Indigenous activists. I shouldn't leave it to Indigenous activists to have to point out that, of course, there have been great acts of violence against Indigenous people by white settlers or invaders here in the past. It's just they haven't happened for a long time. But, yeah, it's remarkable. And the thing and the difficulty there in talking about it is that I think these trends are perhaps obviously, it's no surprise that the 26th of January or the March for Australia down the road were all occurring at that time, but I myself tied the alleged attack, for example, in my mind more to the, at that time, very, very fresh and very recent announced prescription and anti-organised hate group laws that have been announced essentially to put the kibosh on the National Socialist Network. It was, I remember having written something at around that time, just days before that, and I wasn't the only one. There was someone who'd written for the Sydney Morning Herald, for example, about these same sort of concerns. I definitely did have great concerns about how my thought was that if you're going to go to great lengths to allow these extreme groups to suddenly be repressed, legally repressed out of existence, you will essentially create hundreds of lone wolves all at once. Mike Burgess from ASIO's dreaded lone wolves that he repeatedly, you know, and I agree really, but he would always say these are the greatest dangers. The greatest danger isn't a group that's actually working together and they're all training and all that kind of thing with respect to the NSN. He was like, the real danger comes when suddenly all those people are scattered. So what you shouldn't necessarily do is scatter them. He was saying that from an intelligence perspective or a surveillance perspective. It did make sense, essentially, if you're not going to provide any off-ramping in the form of counselling or support, peer-led support for all the families of all these young men who'd been radicalised into the NSN, then you're going to create a lot of very lonely young blokes who had just been allowed to marinate in some pretty extreme and hateful and violence-oriented ideology for several years. Now, that isn't to say that I know these people were among the NSN or not, but some of the loner culture that created was, as a lot of your listeners know, back to front, given everyone you've had on and given all the wealth of knowledge that you lot have yourselves. The whole white supremacist worldview, not just in the NSN, but adjacent to it and around it, orients people naturally and inevitably toward terrorist attacks, doesn't it? Your pre-reading material, prerequisite reading material, just to be literate in their world. You've got to have read Siege, don't you? And you've got to have read all these works that are essentially telling you that your final act should probably be something along the lines of a terrorist attack. So so just getting back to your question, it's like in my mind I more viewed, there was a culmination of several trends. There was the very recent culmination of these laws being built up, these increasingly authoritarian laws meant to stifle protest dissent, not just of the pro-Palestinian movement and people that we like in this house, but also obviously people that we definitely don't like the NSN. It's all been done in tandem. And that thread was the culmination. It was just happening in around that time. The repression suddenly out of existence, where Sewell saw the writing on the wall and he looked at National Action over in the UK and he's like, no, we can't do this anymore. We know what this is going to lead to. So he just called it. Clicked his fingers and he called it. And suddenly all these young blokes were forced to scatter. So all that happened at the same time as the failed Third March for Australia. And I view the trend that led to this proliferation of all these attacks, most of which seem to have been stopped, thankfully, touch wood, I view that trend as being more adjacent to that. The informational thing that led someone like a Liam Hall to want to do what he allegedly wanted to do was, I would identify it as coming from your Advance Australias and everyone who made bread out of attacking Indigenous people and those causes over the course of the Voice campaign and what have you. That set the scene. But I think the bomb makers and what have you were probably situationally radicalised in the moment more by the repression out of existence by the NSN than they were out of these increasingly failed March for Australia rallies. I don't know. Yeah, that's my thought anyway, but it's a tough thought to express. What's your thought on your end, friends?
I think it's as you've said, you're right. There are different tendencies that are drawn to particular events or particular moments, having slightly different, perhaps, agendas. But it seems while that racism has always been present, whether administered by the state or the general population, that kind of continues. I think the kind of the campaign to support the no vote assumes some pretty worrying expressions. And I think it's in that context that it might make it, it's in those contexts that those sorts of actions can make sense to determine political actors and those kind. So it's the, those sorts of things can happen regardless, but the likelihood of those things occurring increases to the extent to which those people understand that this is going to be read as, or they are going to understand it as, a righteous act in defence of the nation. And it brings me, speaking of Perth, I guess it calls to mind the A&M and Mr. Van Tongeren's basic defence that, you know, he who defends his country commits no crime, and so on and so forth. So that kind of, that nationalist impulse really has the effect of, I think it's intended to, absolve all sorts of things that would otherwise be considered terrible crimes. And it's the case, as you said, if you have this core group of fanatical Nazis, suddenly daddy's gone, what do I do? Some of the answers to those questions may be quite worrying. At the same time, the problem is that in one sense that such a coalition was allowed to form and to perform on the streets for years, engaging all sorts of publicity stunts, and that when those who were opposed and understood this threat attempted to take action to disrupt those actions, of course, that's when the police stepped in order to protect them. That was certainly the case in August of last year. A lot of the NSN activities, what they're trying to do, or what they were trying to do, was to build a sufficient force that they, that their dependence on the police and other authorities in order to conduct their street actions and other stunts, they no longer required that protection. And in that sense, they're serious. And the only other thing I'd add is that you've made reference to the Tech Siege. I thought it was, I find it remarkable that the former leader of this group is happy to appear on a vodcast with the author quite recently. And the nature of that text is pretty unambiguous. It calls for Nazi terror. And to the extent that it's popularized, it becomes a kind of standard bearer for a whole range of young men with grievances. That's deeply concerning.
You might say it's unambiguous. It was put to the author that the loony left describes Siege as some sort of terror manual. And the author of that text said it is.
Yeah, sometimes you've got to take these fellas at their word, surely.
And sorry, I actually must have missed that. I've been a bit out of action of late. When was it that they were on a podcast together?
Oh, like a week
two
ago.
2 weeks ago?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So
post-repression, post-dissolution, who do we talk to? Let's talk to the man.
You'll be happy to know, Tom, that the Australian government, just since we're recording, I think, released their reply to their recent inquiry into right-wing extremism in Australia, and they have agreed to the recommendation to undergo periodic evaluations of Australia's DRAD program. So I'm afraid that a lot of the issues you've raised have been dealt with by the government.
Oh, they're going to do some evaluations of their programs.
Problem solved.
I've spoken to ex-NSN members before who've been through these programs, and they're really ineffective. Like, these are programs that are just like people who are, these ex-members report not feeling like at any point like they're actually being cared about more than they are about being watched, you know, or gleaned for any information. These people were never sure whether they were actually talking to like therapists / counsellor type people or just spooks. Because of the nature of the beast, they were never able to find out who these people were, any details about them, which is a little bit, you can imagine going to visit a therapist and they don't tell you what their name is. And, yeah, just some really alienating factors, many others besides that these people report. These are just not, these are some of the most ineffective programs, and the only way to really access them is to either have gotten in trouble for being associated with these groups or to otherwise be recommended by, I suppose, ASIO or the AFP or what have you. And so, again, what does it help if they review their de-radicalisation programs? As we've all discussed, I believe, We need funding for whole other types of programs, peer support ones. Did they talk about anything like that in their reply? Did they say, you know what, maybe it ain't just our DRAP programs that we need on the table. Maybe we need to start really providing some proper support to bring about proper community slash peer led, as in give the funding and the construct for the families of these people to help each other, the people who know more about it than anyone else. Did they make mention of that?
No, I'll say in fairness, this is a pretty light on response to their inquiry. So there's not a lot of detail here.
Hold my breath, mate.
Tom, we've also recently seen in the last couple of days some big moves in the sovereign citizen world as Desi Freeman, who I think everybody thought was dead, has been killed by the police in some sort of shootout in the north of the state. You've covered the sovereign citizen movement in Australia before. Now, of course, Desi Freeman, his sovereign citizen mates are quick to say was not a sovereign citizen because you cannot be a sovereign and a citizen, which seems the most sovereign citizen thing anyone could ever say. What's the reaction been to Desi's death that you've seen?
When I am looking, one of the first places I always seem to find myself looking these days is a really reliable gauge of what the common man thinks, which is looking in Facebook comments. From there, there's a whole culture of obviously doubt around everything, every aspect of Desi Freeman. There was doubt that he was ever, that he was truly alive when he was out there, and there was doubt that he had done what he was said to have done. There is doubt that he had ever died. There's doubt the way in which he was said to have died. There's rumours about how he was taken out by a brown snake, and now that he's taken out this way, people are saying, oh, yeah, I thought you said that he'd been taken out by a brown snake. This proves that he never was. So there's a great culture of doubt because in some respects it seems to every man Facebook clicker that Desi Freeman had become a Ned Kelly-like figure in his anti-police thing, which is pretty incredible because I don't recall that Ned Kelly was ever about to be charged for exposing himself to a child. And that's why I've always been interested in that aspect of Desmond Philby's arrest. That I've wondered if the preoccupation that we have with sovereign citizens has somewhat muddied the water of us being able to get a clear-headed idea of this. But hang on, we've got a bloke here with a charge sheet longer than your arm. I take from the fact that he has a charge sheet longer than your arm that he didn't shoot the police during any of those other charges. I am aware that he'd had a radicalisation towards the deep end, like a lot of people had during the COVID lockdowns era, and like a lot of sovereign citizens had. They were suddenly getting very extreme. So I'm aware that there'd been a pretty radical shift to the extreme from him to the degree of trying to prosecute Daniel Andrews, all that sort of good stuff. I'm aware that all that had happened, but fundamentally what we have is a man who was approached about historical child sexual abuse stuff, and then he shot the police officers who'd come to charge him about that. And I always wondered if, in fact, all the sov-sit talk was helping this man's reputation. It was turning him into a Ned Kelly, despite the fact that I don't want to talk about his sov-sit adherence views. I do think they make the man interesting. I do think that's obviously there's a proliferation of very oddball videos around about the guy, and I recognise that it was relevant in terms of the fact that he explained why he took the rash course that he did. It might have led to some interesting people who might have been able to assist him getting out of Porepunkta and surviving for 7 months. Or if you do want to be on the run from the coppers, you want to be associated with some of that record of people. Yeah, we've all seen sov-sits form rings and abduct children. We've seen them do all kinds of very hectic stuff. So I guess in that respect, it informs the details. But I wondered if all this sov-sit talk might have helped scrub this man's reputation. Interesting the way that it's worked, isn't it? Because, as you said, I did 2 hours of work on sov-sit. Since then, it's become very interesting to everyone and all that work. But I've been interested in the way that which the preoccupation with sov-sittery has served to just muddy the waters around what I think in many other situations would be a fairly clear-cut matter. We'd go, oh, okay, you're one of those types, eh? You're someone who's about to get charged for having done very strange stuff around kids, and then you got away with a great act of violence. That didn't really ever get to be the most popular story around Desmond Philby. Interesting, huh?
Tom, one of the other things you've written about recently is the difficulties people have navigating between fact and fiction, especially online. and navigating these murky waters in order to arrive at something resembling what's actually happening. I'm wondering if you had any thoughts on how others, looking at your own practice, how others can arm themselves in order to better face all this dross and derive some actual substance or meaning from it.
That's an interesting question. And I do feel very defeatist in certain respects, because if you're asking me about how do I feel about the I heard, might have been Popular Front guy Jake Hanrahan talking to someone, and they was agreeing that the era in our world of talking about misinformation and disinformation is almost passe or dead now, because AI and bot-led internet, the dead internet theory almost being almost having manifested as truth these days. And with the great difficulties of discerning truth from fiction in this era, it's almost like all that one, and it's just passe to even talk about it. So I feel really defeatist in certain respect. I really do when it comes to my outlook. But my output is somewhat reduced due to personal life stuff. I still do outputs when I have something to offer. But I know that personally, I always try to cover things, because if you're asking about what do I do in order to continue that fight, you know, I try to cover not simply matters of truth versus fiction, because I'm not necessarily a news channel. And if I'm not, I'm a terrible one, because I don't post things every day. If you were coming to me for the news, you'd be very news starved. But I always try to advance things that I think are of interest to me, and things that are a little bit human-led when I'm looking at matters that otherwise can at this stage just send me into a complete stupor, because I've been looking at them, dealing them, seeing them rise and fall in ways for so long. I try to anchor things in the human-led stuff. Even if these are some of the humans that I hate the most in this world, I keep things human-led because that motivates me. Because I think at this stage of the proceedings, I value my length of service more than I do the currency of my involvement. I think, and I apply that to both of you as well, it's the fact that you've been around so long that lends a quality to your analysis about matters of the far right. That's what I need old war horses around. That's really of value. Oh, I don't care about my tenacity or my relevance as an influencer. I think what's really important is that you've got people around who've seen these trends and can actually apply their insight, you know, to their wealth of knowledge of the names and the faces and the trends of many years in the past. You know what I mean? I don't want to dip out. I want to keep providing my insight, given all my years of experience. And I try to tap into that despite my negativity about this very negative world we're living in, it allows me to keep providing my insight, and telling stories about people is what keeps me in the game. So I do what I can do to keep myself in the game, and that is how I keep fighting misinformation, whatever you want to call it.
Listeners, you heard it from Tom, not from me and Andy. Listen to old white men. If that's his opinion, so be it. We do have to wrap it up there, I'm afraid, Tom. So no time for a reply to that. Thanks for joining us, mate. People can find you at Tom Tanaki, wherever you get your contents.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Andy, we will be back next week. See you later.
We will. Thanks, Tom. See you then.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love, and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.